Welcome to Paper Money, the podcast covering the business side of the game industry. I'm Ben Clark.
And I'm Rhett Kipp.
Today is February 25th, 2012.
Dum, dum, dum.
I know. And what's really cool, by the way, is that this is a leap year.
Yes, it is.
So we actually have I might try and release this show on February 29th just because of that.
Just because you had the opportunity to do it. You know, it's an election year. Every election year is a leap year.
I never thought of that. What a great way to remember that. Thank you very much, Rhett.
You'd get one extra day to be
campaigned. Yeah. So, well, you know, here in Michigan, the Michigan primary is on Tuesday. So if you haven't been paying attention as to where the candidates are hanging out, it's been here. So I've gotten one Rick Santorum mailing and a stack of Mitt Romney mailings.
Well, I expect mine's going to be really fun. My election is on the 20th of March, and I'm guessing if we see anything, it'll be amazing over in this district.
Well, you know the cool thing, though, right, about this being an election year, is that this used to be the time of year when Mayfair would actually move copies of Road to the White House.
It's true. I don't even think they're trying this year.
No. They actually, you know what they did? I was talking to Larry Rosney a couple years ago, and the last election cycle, they sold like the last 4,000 or 5,000 copies they had in bulk to somebody.
Cool.
Yeah. So they're officially done with it. And now, for those of you who don't know, Road to the White House, I think it came out, what, like 1984? And
Something like that.
It's an older game. Maybe it was the early 90s. Suffice to say, that what was the quote from Darwin Bromley about the marketing of that product?
It wasn't Darwin. Darwin was in charge of the company, but it was in a quote from Darwin. But the quote was that they would have been better off to have shrink-wrapped a $20 bill to every one of the games.
Yeah, exactly. That one. So, folks, if you're designing a political game, you have a window between now and September. Every 4 years you get that window to sell your game, and that's it. So anyways, let's move on from that. I'm sure that, you know what, later on in the year we will cover at least one political game.
Would not be surprised.
Yeah.
And you know, one of my favorite ones as a continual seller is from Z-Man, and it's nice because it really isn't about the current election.
Would that be 1960?
That would be about 1960. It's a great game.
Fantastic game. And I highly recommended whether or not it's an election year.
Yes. Anyway.
So that said, let's move on. We have some news this week. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the stuff coming out of Toy Fair. And we're also going to talk about art. And we're going to go ahead.
Art is important. I actually have a whole little thing to go on about this. So go ahead.
Oh, fantastic. So I was worried it was just going to be me rambling on about art technical details for, you know, 30 minutes. But great, you have some stuff too.
I do.
All right, let's talk about New York Toy Fair. New York Toy Fair was last week. For those of you who haven't been following, David Miller on the Purple Pawn has been posting some great stuff about his trip to Toy Fair. And the big news for me out of Toy Fair is Hasbro pushing games. Not normally it's a Barbie and a toy event for them. But this year their big push was their Zapped games with APP in the center capitalized. Basically, imagine the game of life with your iPad strapped to the center of the board.
I should mention they don't usually push Barbie given that's Mattel.
Oh, sorry. Good point. No, but even Mattel this year, Mattel's big push was also iPad integrated games.
Yes.
They have a different trademark term for it, but basically you can buy special Hot Wheels too for $20 and run them across the screen of your iPad.
Really?
Yeah, they have special non-scratch wheels.
Awesome.
Personally, awesome. I think this is inviting disaster when your child takes their other Hot Wheels cars. But I'm assuming that the special wheels also register as a touch, right, on the iPad screen, so the other ones might not. But again, This is interesting to me. We've been talking about iPad apps and things like that, and this is there was a company who came out. Remember, we talked about this a few shows ago. There's a company who released a game board that, you know, you would put your iPad in, and that was the heart and soul of the game. And Now the big companies are doing it. Now, I have not been able to find out if they license the technology from this other company or if they're just going to basically say, ha, we're Hasbro and Mattel, try and sue us. But it is I think, how can I say this? A gimmick.
I won't go far from saying it's a gimmick, but you know, there's a lot of gimmicks that work.
True. On the other hand, a gimmick where you sell a $20 game or a $25 game that requires you purchase a $500 technical gizmo.
Well, but I guess what they're really after there is that most of the people own the technical gizmo.
It could be. And again, I think this is a mass market thing. I don't see. How can I say this? One, it takes all the fun out of the Euro games. But where I see this would be kind of cool in the hobby sector is to tie this into an RPG.
Yeah, you know, and
difficult, but interesting.
I think there's a lot of application that hasn't even been touched on yet.
Correct.
But in any case, I think this is, as you say, why it's mass market. How do you not avoid it when the success of things like Angry Birds on the apps and so on and so forth?
True. And again, this is just me being old school and crabby and stuff. But again, that was their kind of, that was the feature announcement from those two companies. I was going through all the news reports, and that's really what came up over and over and over again in the news feeds was Hasbro zapped and Mattel's, I don't know, it's like in it, there's an I and an app and something. But anyways, these integrated games were kind of their feature rollouts for Toy Fair. And again, a lot of times Toy Fair is a lot more about toys than it is about games. But again, interesting news. That's from the big boys. Don't know that will percolate down to the hobby market, but it's interesting to know that's the direction they're going in. Because for years, there was always the digital divide, right? Every decade or so, they try and incorporate electronic gizmos into board games. And with exception of possibly electronic battleship, it's never really been, you know, none of them have ever really become mainstays.
No, they've been very unsuccessful at that.
Correct. So we'll have to see how that goes. And now, in the other Hasbro news item of the week, or actually of the month, Universal threw in the towel on their Hasbro deal.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that or not. For those of you who haven't been following, we covered this sometime last year. Universal made a huge deal with Hasbro to turn Hasbro's board game licenses into movies. And it was an awful, awful deal. And they were rushing movies into production because the penalties for not producing them were something like $5 million a movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was a 3 or 5 movie deal, I believe.
Oh, it was more than that. It was a 6-year deal. And there were going to be at least 4 major feature films come out of it.
Okay.
And it was supposed to expire in like 2014. Universal decided they hated the idea so much that they basically paid a multi-million dollar fine covering all of the licenses they have not produced. And the only movie that they still have in production is Battleship.
Yeah, I did see a trailer for Life. I'm really glad they didn't do it.
Well, I know that. Well, I mean, now this doesn't mean
the game of life as a movie, just bizarre.
I have no response to that. But now this doesn't mean the movies won't get made. But for instance, Candyland got fobbed off to Sony as an Adam Sandler vehicle. Clue has been fobbed off, I think, on Relativity Media. And I think Ouija, I don't know if anybody picked up Ouija. I think that was going to be like a Michael Bay film or something awful, or produced by Michael Bay. Suffice to say, these movies have all been shuffled off. And now here's the thing. Transformers was a great movie license, right? There's a backstory to Transformers. Board games, there's no backstory to.
No.
No. So, and I understand now Stretch Armstrong may still be in development somewhere, by the way, but really, these are the dumbest. This was a terrible idea, and I'm glad to see it go away. Sorry for Hasbro that their licenses aren't going to necessarily get produced, but this wasn't a great idea.
No. Clue actually of those has a backstory, let's be honest. Clue was already made into a movie.
Yes, and if you have a certain appreciation for the comedic talents involved, it wasn't a bad movie.
No, it was also a very strange, five-ending movie.
Three. But I'd watch Michael McKean read a phone book. I'm a big fan. But
anyway, yeah, we digress.
Suffice to say, Universal threw in the towel on the Hasbro deal. Some of these movies are going to get made. Thankfully, I think we're going to be spared the worst of them. But it just goes to show, folks, if you run a major movie studio and you lack family content, don't go to Hasbro for it. Because their lawyers are better than your lawyers. I think that's really what this came down to. Or at least don't try and fix it all in one deal. So those of you running major movie studios listening to the show, there's some solid advice for you based on hard-earned experience at Universal.
And if you are, you know, one of those people, could you please, you know, give us a call, send us an email?
Yeah, put us on retainer. We're smart guys. So that said, let's move on. One of the other things we talked about, and this has been also David Miller, I think, has authored a couple of stories on this on the Purple Pond. Might have been Sam or one of the other writers over there. We talked about the unofficial Dominion application.
Right.
And it turns out Jay Tummelson said, yeah, that's no problem. I've told a bunch of guys they're welcome to do an unofficial Dominion app as long as it's free, and they pull it off the market when the regular Dominion app comes out. And so he was really surprised when this app came out, but it was okay. He'd given it his blessing. So I thought that was very interesting to see that they were taking that approach with their titles.
Yeah.
Now, so all of you rushing to go learn Objective-C, remember, you have to give the app away for free and pull it off the market when they come out with theirs that they're going to charge for. Not so much of a good deal, but as a programming exercise, sounds kind of cool.
Yeah. You know, if you're a fan and you want it out there, it's a nice thing. And maybe it's a gateway in for you.
Well, you know, I was thinking as a business strategy for Rio Grande, it's not a bad deal at all.
No.
Right? So they're not losing any money. Theoretically, and you know, it keeps the license out there. So, again, kudos to Jay Tummelson for basically going with that model. I think it's not a bad model at all. And finally, excuse me, not actually finally, but our final specific news item, Rhett, you were talking about the Flames of War giveaway earlier before the show,
right?
And we've mentioned this before. Go ahead and the details on this is that Battlefront is giving away
what appears to be about 70,000 copies of the complete rules in their reduced format. They're what we would refer to as journal size. I believe Europe is A5. Maybe it's A4. I forget their terminology specific. Anyway, it's the complete rules, 300 and some odd pages of rules in a free giveaway. If you have a hardcover second edition. You simply bring it into your current local retailer who carries the product. They sticker it. They give you the free book. It's painless.
You realize that for a company not named Games Workshop to be doing a 70,000 print run of a giveaway item is, you know, that's just staggering.
It's, you know, for anybody, you know, the last time I saw anybody outside of them. Now, this is the second time they've done it, which is amazing. The last time I saw anybody do something like this was probably close to 10 years ago when AEG had so many problems in their first printings of the, not Legend of the Five Rings, their Seven Seas RPG, that they, when they came out with the upgraded printing, they have a 48-page giveaway that they produced. And again, it was an enormous print run.
Sure, 48 pages, though, compared to
300 and some odd, all color, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is a huge thing. And a testimony, by the way, to the popularity of Flames of War, which I always thought, oh, this is kind of cool, but it's historical miniatures. And yet it's really done extremely well. So kudos to Battlefront to A, supporting their fan base, and B, coming up with a great product that people like to play.
Yeah.
So, and speaking of things that people like to play, the Purple Pond just released their 2011 industry survey, or their 2012 industry survey, however you want to look at it. They do this once a year, and they send out, Yehuda sends out thousands of requests for response, right? So he has a database with 6,900 game-related companies in it. And he got responses from 391 of these countries. And basically, he asked them about, is your company doing better or worse than last year? Are you still in business? and, you know, if you know, what are your better selling product lines? And it was very interesting this year. He says that about, I think, just over 7% in total of the companies that were in the survey last year are out of the survey this year due to going out of business. And it didn't seem to be specific in terms of retail versus publisher or whatever. I think the single game companies fared worse than the others, which is not surprising. Again, it was what was amazing for me were two facts. One, the companies that didn't close, he says the overwhelming majority are doing fine or even better than last year. Only 13% report doing worse than last year. And of the responding retailers, the top performing game lines from last year, Magic the Gathering, Catan, Dominion, and Warhammer, were the top this year. And here's the kicker. Pathfinder products outperformed D&D products by 2-1. Last year, they were about even. Now, that's not our opinion. This was based on the survey that the Purple Pawn did. Again, if you want to see the full, it's an 18-page PDF download. It's free. Take a look at it. But that Pathfinder number really leapt out at me.
Well, and, you know, I think it probably leapt out at Wizards because, well, we all know what Wizards is doing right now.
Yeah, well, exactly, which is planning for a 2013 reboot.
Yeah.
On D&D.
This is a major turnaround. This would be, you know, I can't even imagine what this would be for Wizards. It would be, you know, finding another CCG that outperformed Magic. It would be astonishing. Mm-hmm. Wizards, on the other hand, has done extremely well, as we've talked about here, of reinvigorating Magic.
Yes, and I wish them the absolute best of luck. I hope that – I know that 4th edition was them trying to do a bit of a reboot, and it was not everyone's cup of tea, obviously. And the trick with any reboot is to keep your core fans and attract new ones. And that with 4th edition – that the core fans were the ones who were not big fans of it and left in droves, yes, apparently, for Pathfinder.
In very large amounts, obviously.
Yeah, but anyways, it was interesting to see, because we've always talked that they were neck and neck, but to see them reported as outperforming, I don't want to say outselling, the D&D products by 2-1, that was very interesting. And again, I'm looking forward to 5th edition AD&D. I said AD&D. How old am I now? Like 100? But... I think it'll be interesting to see where they position the product. Do they say, okay, we've surrendered that one particular audience to Pathfinder, you know, and we're going to concentrate on this other audience here? Or do they say, we're going to try and get the Pathfinder people back?
Yeah, my suspicions is we're going to see a tooth and claw fight. I really do think that they're going to come out with all guns blazing and very much targeted at their, you know, their 3rd edition crowd to see what they can do to recover them and expand.
Yeah, and I think the only ones who can benefit are all of us consumers and players.
Well, I think a number of people could benefit from it, but yeah. I think certainly that's the big advantage for, you know, consumers, as you know, we're gonna be catered to in an interesting way.
I hope so. Hopefully this will lead to the thing that has bugged me for some time about Gen Con. Lack of swag. The last couple of years, swag at Gen Con has been pretty poor. I got more free stuff. I was down in Jacksonville for the National Breast Cancer Marathon. I got more free stuff for doing that than I have gotten at Gen Con in the last 3 years combined. So,
well, if swag is your deal, I think Adepticon should be your target event, because apparently their giveaway, walking through the door giveaway goodie bag is just insane.
All right, I have a friend over here in Michigan who is associated with running that, so I'll have to buttonhole him about that and see if it's going to be worth the drive. That said, again, go over to the Purple Pawn, download the industry survey, and check it out. He breaks it down. There's some pie charts and stuff about what sectors of the industry reported doing, you know, what percentage said we're doing great or we're doing good or we're doing worse than normal. And he breaks it down, you know, retailers, manufacturers, distributors, etc. And it's interesting. It's interesting reading if you're in the business, just to see, you know, basically the pulse of the industry reduced to easy format, right? This is the kind of thing that normally you'd be wondering about.
And yes.
Yes, exactly. And here, Yehuda at Purple Pawn went ahead and did that. And again, go ahead, download it. It's free. And Rhett, I have to ask one more question before we move on to our commentary about art.
Yes.
Catalyst Game Labs actually got 25th introductory BattleTech back in print.
Yes, they're in stores.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. So, just wanted to make sure. So, just let me know off the mic here when Leviathan is coming out. So,
very often asked question.
Oh, I'm certain Randall's getting tired of it about this point, actually. But hopefully...
I believe Randall has been tired of it for more than just this point. And we will stop there because it just doesn't go pleasant from that point on.
Well, you know, the Gamma Trade Show is coming up next month. In fact, we're going to talk about that in our end of March show. The announcement's coming out of GTS. Should be interesting to see if that's one of the items announced there. Also, I think FFG is going to make – don't they usually do their rest of the year lineup? And GTS, I can't remember.
Pretty much everybody does, but yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So anyways, we should have some fun targets listed after GTS, so we'll see how that goes. Now, let us move on and talk about art. I'm not talking about art Schleister. I am not talking about the art in the Louvre. I am talking about game art. And
well, wouldn't that be in the Louvre then? Anyway, we're done. We'll go down that path. Thank you.
That said, there's a lot to think about when you are producing a game. All right. Generally, what's going to happen is you're going to design a game and you're going to start playtesting this game. And as you get into the middle of playtesting somewhere, you're going to start calling printers and you're going to start getting estimates. And they're going to ask you questions about physical specifications that you will have no clue. Right. And this is generally how this goes, right? The first time you do anything like this, and you'll narrow down your physical specifications. When you finally set on your physical specifications, this is now the time when you should do your artwork. You should not start your artwork. Well, I guess you can start your artwork earlier, but let's face it, you need to be flexible because what's going to happen is you're going to design all of your cards for 3 inches by 4 inches and then find out that it's going to cost you $8 a deck to produce a cards in that size or something like that. So you're going to have to resize the art to 2.5 by 3.5 inches and produce a standard deck. So start your art whenever you want, but don't finalize it till after you've talked to your printer. So, sorry, Rhett, I have to get that in there. That was like my pet thing as a printer when someone would come to me with art that was defective and then we had to change all the sizes anyway. So, I want to first talk about aesthetic considerations about your art. And then we're going to talk about practical considerations and a couple of technical considerations for you to consider.
Well, before we go a little further here,
yeah,
you should specify what art you're referencing to. Are you referring to cover art? You're referring to card art? Which art are you referencing?
I am referring to all of it.
Okay.
In fact, even your rules are considered art. This is a huge oversight. And I mentioned this later on, but I'll talk about this here. You can't give your printer a Microsoft Word document. For your rules.
No, it is important that we start out by explaining that, I think, to everyone, what we're talking about when we're talking about art.
Basically anything that gets printed on paper is considered art, and you are going to have to be responsible for. So good call on that. The first thing you got to do is make sure that your art is suitable to your game. So, for instance, black and white interior art on, say, a role-playing game supplement or even a role-playing game rulebook is completely acceptable with a color cover. It is not acceptable to print a black and white board game. You just can't have a black and white board, right?
It would be a little odd.
Yes, it would be a little odd, but you have to think about that. The other thing you have to think about too is I have seen a lot of people use pencil and ink sketches. Using colored pencil, and it was very good colored pencil, and watercolors. These are two things that look terrible on a board game. And
yes,
in general, unless it's a very vibrant, rich watercolor, it's not going to look good in RPG or cards as well.
The problem, therefore, to give an explanation of what the problem is it washes out.
It washes out and it doesn't jump off the page. So there's so much white space for instance, when you do a pencil, like a colored pencil sketch, even if that art is really great art, it's so white, really, is what happens. It's so light. It doesn't leap off the page. It's not going to sell the product. And in fact, with watercolors, one of the games that I love almost boffed it, and because I the art on it, I think it borders on a problem, and that's Chronicle of the Godslayer. And it's in particular the card art, I find is a lot of it. I don't know that it's not, maybe it's just me. Okay. Maybe that's at the gathering. People are going to tell me that this is great art. I didn't think it was good art on the cards, and it part of it, cause I thought it didn't fit the theme as well as it could have. But again, this was a thing too, where they used a lot of, like I said, if you take a look at the art, I don't want to say it's colored pencil, but it's not. Anyways, it wasn't oil painting.
It wasn't a painting, yeah.
Which looks great on cards because it's, you know, very richly colored. That said, so make your art suitable to your game. Now, for another good example of this is, Rhett, we've talked about this before. There are certain levels of art standard for your product. So, for instance, if you're doing war game rules, it's pretty much expected that they're going to be all text, black and white. Maybe you'll reprint a table. In any, although a lot of them don't even do that anymore. They just refer you to the actual copy of the table. And you don't need any adornment in those rules.
At least at the extreme end, you could get away with that. But there are, you know, modern wargame rules are becoming much more, you know, well-crafted. We'll get into the term for color. And all the top stuff now is four color, mostly showing lots of pictures.
Correct. And if you're, for instance, the FFG games, which have lavish production values, have that. But if you look at GMT Case Yellow, for instance, there's a black and white lithograph on the cover of the rules that's basically a reprint of the box art, and that's it. There are pictures of the counters in there, but it's not full color. And now some of them are. Some of them do have full color depictions of the counters. I know that some of the other games too, Conflict of Heroes has color and some of that. But again, if you're doing your first game, you can get away with black and white in that industry with no pictures. If you're doing a role playing game supplement, you can get away with a first printing of a small press rule book. Black and white interior printing is fine, but you're still going to need artwork and some nice layout. You're going to have to put some thought into typography and interior art. So again, these are things to consider. And when I say suitable to your game, go look at what else. Go look at the other products on the market. Right. This is who you're competing against. So
that's one of the best things you can suggest always. Go look at what the competition is doing, and you have to think in terms of, can you follow suit?
And if you can't,
if there's a reason, you know, economically speaking, you know, you're an indie press guy and you need to do something less, then you need to figure out how you're going to get the most impact out of your art.
Correct. And there's, if you want to do something that no one else has done, there's probably a reason. And I say that somewhat jokingly. For instance, say you go, oh, what I want to do is an embossed cover. Well, the reason nobody does an embossed cover is because it's expensive. And the reason nobody does, you know, silver foil covers is because they're expensive. The reason nobody does, you know, a lot of things is because it's expensive. And you don't want to do that with your first product if it's not in your budget, right? If you have to make a choice whether to have the cool embossed cover or, you know, some other, you know, key component, then you need to ditch the embossed cover kind of a thing. So again, these are things to think about. Make it suitable for your game and your market. And now let's move on to the next topic here, which is you got to have color art on the outside, period.
Pretty much.
Yes.
Very, very few things can get away nowadays with two color.
Correct. I think I've seen some three color stuff where it was like, for instance, yellow, black and white, or red, black and white. And I think those were some miniatures rule supplements.
Some of the new, you know, like I see some of the indie press RPGs are in two color.
Correct. And they are indie press. Again, for their market, that is acceptable.
Correct.
For the most part. But let's take a board game, for example. All right. You need color on the top and bottom of the box. I was asked repeatedly when I was quoting board games, well, can we save money and just do the bottom of the box in black and white? And I'm like, well, yeah, but it's not a good idea. And the reason is, the top of the box captures interest, and the back of the box sells the game.
Absolutely.
And this is true of role-playing games, miniatures games, whether it's a box or a book. The front captures the interest and the back sells it.
And we've said this a number of times, but since we're talking about art, and I'm going to reiterate it here, one of the critical places that a lot of people, in my opinion, really fall down is on either their spine art for a book or on their side panel art for a box set. That is going to be the primary way your product is going to be displayed. You really want to think of a good way for your logo to appear, for your name to appear, of the product, and that it'll still be eye-catching.
That's correct, actually. And, for instance, you don't have to go as overboard as, say, for instance, Catalyst Game Labs, where if you put all six books together, they form a panoramic image. But decorating the spine or the side box of your game is an absolutely critical component. In fact, I used to tell people one of the reasons you don't want to use a Monopoly-style game box is because you only got about an inch and a quarter of space to sell that game when it's stacked edge-on. And it's tough to do anything in an inch and a quarter. So, again, consider this when you're doing your art. The back of the box, though, in terms of artwork, there's a lot of stuff that's got to go on there, right? You've got to have, you need space for your UPC or your ISBN. You need some flavor text. You need some hardcore text. A lot of times you'll want to list the contents of the box. And for gosh sakes, you've got to have information easily available that tells people how many players, what ages, and how long it takes to play the game.
Absolutely. Yeah, and a good graphic for that is also really handy.
Yeah,
those are easy to copy nowadays because they're becoming kind of universal as far as the graphics for those displays.
Exactly. And it's stuff that you have to have on the back of the game, because the first thing I'm going to do is flip this game over and figure out, am I going to be able to play this with my kids or not? Right. Is this am I going to be able to, is this 10 and up? Is this 14 and up? What's the complexity level? So again, that's the kind of information you want. And again, this is all part of your artwork that needs to go on the back of the box. And in addition to that, a lot of people don't have back of the box art prepared, right? They've got a cover for the box. They have a game board for their game. They don't necessarily have anything at all planned for the back of the box. Reuse some of the art. You can just, change the perspective a little bit and use the board, use the art from the front cover or the board itself and superimpose all the text and stuff you need over top of it. Nobody's going to be paying attention to that part of the artwork on the back of your box.
Yeah. But one of the other things I will say is, especially on front cover art, be it box art or be it books, and even more important on books than boxes, a lot of displays are cascade. If you don't know what that means, it's basically one box or book stacked in front of another. So mostly like the top third of it is on display.
Like stadium seating in the movie theater.
Like stadium seating. Yes, exactly. You need to make sure that your product's name appears there, because that may be the only place that is seen on your product as well.
Yeah, that's so true with books. I hadn't even thought about that because I'm thinking, board games. But yeah, exactly.
And when you think about your art in the first place, take into consideration where those logos are going to go, because you don't want to have some beautiful piece of art with this logo that's going to obscure the best part of it.
Correct. Correct. Absolutely. And all this stuff, again, this comes down to the saleability of your product. Right. This is the stuff you need to be thinking about before you start. Now, some of the other considerations you want to think about, here's some practical stuff here, is when you go to do this very, very important artwork, do not use your buddy unless his last name is Vallejo. In which case, then maybe you can use your good buddy to do the artwork. Unless your good buddy is really freaking good, you might want to contact a professional, okay? Because you're sitting next to this guy and he's been doodling in homeroom for years, barbarians with swords and stuff. He might not know his ass from a hole in the ground when it comes to using digital tools like Photoshop or Illustrator, and you will need to use those. So you might be able to get a deal on an art student. You might be able to get a deal on a professional, but quite frankly, it's going to cost more than you think. Okay, for a board game, $5,000 is often the floor for artwork. All right, for box board cards and a rule book layout, that's the floor from a when I was doing it, and I, you know, we had a couple of guys who, you know, were freelance who we, you know, would set people up with on a regular basis. That's pretty much what they would tell people. Right? You're looking at $3,000 to $5,000, and it could go higher depending on how. What you, you know, I don't want to say how picky you are, because it makes it sound like they're going to, you know, paint with a Q-tip or something and, you know, do it all in Microsoft Paint. But, what that means is if you have a definite idea of what you like and you let your, and you trust your artist to execute on it, you're going to be good. If you want to pick every single shade of color and minutely adjust everything, expect your bill to go from 5,000 to 10,000 very quickly when you're working with an artist. And the other one thing you need to know about artwork is that it's harder than you think. So when you say, well, I won't have my buddy do it, I'll do it myself. Ask Kurt Schilling. All right. Kurt Schilling, very, very famous baseball player who some of you may have heard of, also did the counter. He didn't do the counter art. He did the layout. Okay. He was, I think he was using Quark Express. He was doing the layout for one of the reprints of, his game company, that printed the, Multi-Man Publishing, who produces Advanced Squad Leader. And I think it was Beyond Valor. And one of the sheets ended up getting grossly misprinted. And like all the numbers were wrong, or so there was stuff superimposed or whatever. And Kurt actually put out a one-page explanation of how this happened in one of the ASL journals. And people were just like, we don't care. You know, this is, it's just wrong. How could you possibly let this go through production? And the answer is that there are about a dozen ways that this can go wrong. You will always need to check your proofs. It always helps if, you know, just never, ever assume that the artwork you submitted is going to be exactly the same as the artwork that came out.
Yeah, it's amazing sometimes that beautiful art that you've done over and over, you know, you're a professional company, you've done these multiple times. Somehow, when it gets sent to the printer, things change.
Yeah, and it does.
It baffles us a number of times.
It does. And a lot of that is the reason, and we'll come, there's a lot to talk about here in the technical considerations, but, one of the reasons for that is what happens when you send it to the printer. All right. They lay it out for their press. All right. They're not going to, they don't want you generally to put 100 cards on a single, page in Adobe Illustrator and then have to tweak each card individually to get it to set up correctly with the correct bleeds and everything else on their printer. So what they usually want you to do is they're going to make you submit basically, if you, with Adobe Illustrator, is basically one file per card. And you go, oh my gosh, it's a 110 card deck. Well, yes, that's true. But what they're going to do is they have software that's basically going to, or a macro that's basically going to throw these down in one Adobe Illustrator or Quark Express document and lay it out so that the spacing is correct for the bleeds and the cuts and all the stuff that they have to do to turn these into cards. So, it's much harder than you think, and it goes through a lot of changes that you think. I've seen proofs signed off on that still had die lines on them, and which was the printer's fault. And I've seen proofs signed off on where they were missing the name of the game on the box, which is the person who submitted the game's fault. But again, there's a lot of stuff that can go wrong. So it is harder and more time consuming and more expensive than you think. And finally, talking a lot about color and black and white. Color costs about 5 times more than black and white, but it makes 20 times the impression. And Rhett, you and I have both seen Colonel Lou Zaki's speech on getting into the game industry.
Right.
And one of the things he talks about is, oh, you go to the box manufacturer and get these old white label boxes that they're not using, and you can, you know, slap a, you know, you photocopy some stuff and stick it to the front. That worked in 1980. Maybe even
kind of,
yeah exactly.
Worked in the '70s.
Yeah, exactly. We're not going to say that that was ever, you know, the approved practice. But for launching a game, you could actually get away with it. You can't do that anymore, and you need to have color on the outside. Yes, it does cost a lot more, but again, go to your local game store and other than Cow, Q-U-A-O, I don't know of any black and white games that have come out in a long time, solely black and white.
This game has not been playtested, and it's follow-on. I believe those are from Asmodee.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
And it looks very generic because it's kind of the whole point of it.
Quick, name the only black and white hit, and that would be Kill Dr. Lucky, right? James Ernest did it in black and white.
And it started in black and white and is no longer black and white.
It is now
truly spectacular now.
Yeah, that is correct. And finally, when you hear your printer talk about four color art, this means any color you want.
specifically yes. what 4Color is, and you sometimes hear it referred to as CMYK art. What we're referring to, CMYK, is sienna, magenta, yellow, and key. Key is black.
So
what you're looking
cyan,
for there is,
yeah.
if you're not really familiar with those words, blue, red, yellow, and black.
Correct. Those 4 colors are overlaid to produce just about millions of colors. What you're not going to get with that, all right, you're not going to get silver ink. You're not going to get, you know, special glitter ink or things like that. And there's another type of color that you can use called PMS spot colors. So, for instance, if you're doing a licensed game of from BP, all right, BP will tell you, this is the specific ink color for green, and there's a premixed ink called a PMS color that you will have to use for that color green. You don't want to use any PMS colors if you can avoid it. And the reason for that is that most presses are 5 or 6 color. All right. The 6 color is always going to be taken up by the coating. Okay. Which is a clear coating that protects the ink. The 5th slot you don't want to pay for, and the other 4 are going to be CMYK. So use CMYK. Art, do not use any other colors. And by the way, for those of you who go, haha, my friend is a web designer, he can do art. Your friend is used to designing in a color scheme called RGB, red, green, blue. This is not suitable for printing.
Yeah, one of the things
what will
you
happen
should
is,
look into yeah. if you're going to start doing this is a Pantone book. It will tell you how to break out the colors.
Correct, yeah. And now that said, a Pantone chip book is expensive.
Yes, it is.
So try and borrow one. I mean, we're like $1,500.
Haka Child or something like
that's
that.
Right. Yeah, yeah. They're about $1,500 for a full set of the books. So, but that said, what you want to do is you want to do your art from the ground up in CMYK. It's a color choice in Photoshop or Illustrator, and not RGB. Because what will happen is you're going to go at the last minute, you're going to convert from RGB to CMYK for the printer. And all of a sudden, your art is going to look all different. All the shades are going to be off. It will affect your artwork. It's not something you want to deal with. That said, we've been kind of implying this. But we haven't said it. Your artwork has to be digital. You cannot I know I was working with this one lady off and on for about a year. And she was a New Orleans resident. She was a fantastic artist. And she basically had a stand in the French Quarter and made a very good living doing that. But she didn't do digital art. She painted a beautiful game board, and there was no way that I could print that. The only way that you can do that, you can theoretically find somebody who's got a super high resolution scanner and wide bed scanner to scan in your 20-inch game board. But otherwise, it's not going to work. And even then, its chances are it's going to look fuzzy because it's bitmapped. So again, your artwork has to be digital. It's best if it's digital from the ground up. Now, Rhett, I'm going to get off into the technical stuff here for a minute, but I have to say, the other thing you need to do with your digital artwork, and we've talked a little bit about the CMYK, and I need to come back to this. Some colors are really hard to match or keep consistent. Purple and orange are the absolute worst on this, right? There are oranges that will look brown when you print them. And
absolutely.
Yeah, they look great on your screen, and like they look like turd on your they really do on your when you print them on paper. But purple is terrible for consistency. I have seen, honest to God, a stack of games with purple sides, and in that stack of 10 games there wasn't a one of them that was the same color, the same
no you
shade.
can if you see a lot of purple together, you can see lots of shading in it.
Yeah, go find stacks. I think War Age of Imperialism is the last purple game I know of, but from Eagle Games. But again, it's really hard to match up. And this was, you know, I was at a, you know, working at a printer at the time, and we were pulling our hair out trying to get consistent runs on these game boxes. And it doesn't matter so much on the game box a lot of the time, as they'll only you won't normally display a stack of 10 in that manner. However, where it does matter is your cards.
Yeah.
All right, so if you have 100 cards that are purple and they run the purple isn't quite the same shade, all of a sudden it's like marking your deck. So it's something to keep in mind, something very much to keep in mind when you do that. So, oh, and the other thing I wanted to talk about was color schemes, right? If no one has ever complimented you on your fashion sense, talk to someone else about picking colors for your game, right? You can have a general idea, but talk to someone who knows what they're doing about colors. All right, there's a reason that, for instance, you don't see a lot of plaid game boxes. And so, again, talk to an artist, get that opinion. The other thing I wanted to mention was talk to your printer. Your printer is your friend here, all right? Because you're going to be looking at this thing on probably an unmatched color monitor, all right? Now, if you don't know what a matched color monitor is, or a color-matched monitor, excuse me, then, again, chances are you need to talk to somebody because the colors you see on your screen, unless you have taken great care, are not going to match the colors that get printed out on your printer. They just won't. So you need to. So you're gonna want to talk to your printer early, or excuse me, your artist about color matched monitors. But if you talk to your printer early, what they're gonna do is they're gonna get you dye lines. Okay, dye lines are basically it's a layer that you can superimpose over your existing artwork to make sure that, for instance, the box edges go all the way to the edges. Always good to know. For instance, they're also going to have things like, for instance, on the boxes, you can't stop your – say you have a 3.5-inch tall box, right? You can't stop your art at 3.5 inches. You have to have a bleed, right? You have to – because that box wraps around the bottom of the box. And so you need to actually print – you need to overprint. I probably shouldn't explain bleed. Go to Wikipedia and look up bleed on color because everything you print is going to have to go over the edge, right? So a 3.5-inch card is going to get stamped out on a die. So you need to have the colors go over the edge of the card by about 1/8 of an inch in case that die is off by a smidge. So again, things like that, your printer is going to know, and every printer is going to have a specific set of die lines they want you to use for their templates. So do that. The other thing is you're going to have to use a real graphics program. You're going to have to use Adobe Illustrator or Quark Express or something similar to that. Again, your printer will have a list of programs that are acceptable. You're not going to be able to use Microsoft Word. You're not going to be able to use Microsoft Publisher. You're not going to be able to use Microsoft Paint. You probably won't be able to use just Microsoft Photoshop. And the reason for you not using Microsoft Photoshop has to do with the fact that photo programs are designed to use bitmapped art. What happens is when you try, anyone who's blown up a photo or shrunk it down knows what happens. It gets fuzzy. It gets hard to read. It looks ugly. Now, if you're using Illustrator or Quark or whatever like that, they don't store the individual bitmaps. They store the pattern. So when you have text in Adobe Illustrator, it basically, it stores the ray tracing design of an R, so you can so you can blow that letter R up to 3 feet or shrink it down to 1/8 of an inch, and it will still have sharp, crisp edges. And that's hugely important when you start doing card art, and all of a sudden you're printing all that tiny text down at the bottom of the card. So what's going to happen with your cards? And again, I'm going off the technical deep end, Rhett. I apologize. Most of our listeners just got, let's go look at the Dan Savage podcast. What happens is you're going to store the background for your cards in Photoshop, right? Some lavishly detailed oil painting type thing that you have as a highly detailed bitmap, not a JPEG or a GIF, right? By the way, because those are lossy formats. They will not lousy, lossy. They lose detail the more you compress them. But anyways, you'll put that as your background, and then your text that goes over the top on your game box, on your cards, and on anywhere else you can do it is going to be done in, you're going to do that in Illustrator so that it, again, it's ray traced art, so you can expand it, shrink it, contract it, whatever, move it around, and it won't pixelate and look like blurry crap. Red, is this more than you ever wanted to know about card art?
No, that's not more than I ever wanted to know about card art.
Oh, excellent, excellent. On a final note, there's two types of coatings, by the way, that you can put on your art or on your paper. Aqueous and UV. Most printers do one or the other. It used to be aqueous was slightly cheaper. Anymore, it just depends on what equipment they tend to have set up. UV is about the same price. The only difference with UV is there is a wider range of gloss coatings. All right, so you can get a super high gloss UV coat. It's not going to be a huge issue unless they assume that you want high gloss UV. And again, it makes the cards really hard to shuffle. So that said, Rhett, I think we're pretty much done with the intro to art. We can go on and on and on. I'm more to the point. I can go on and on and on about this stuff for another hour. But let's spare our listeners and your PC
there
from that discussion. So, Rhett, how can people comment on art? Because as we all know, everyone likes to critique art.
Well, you can email us at papermoney@purplepawn.com. You can Skype us at Paper Money Podcast,
or you can track us down on our RSS feed. That's purplepawn.com/category/papermoney/feed. The Purple Pawn has its own RSS feed for all the articles, but this is just the stream for the podcast. And again, if you want to find out when the new shows are up, that's the place to find it. And Rhett, we don't mention it here in our listener mail segment that often, but you can post comments on all of the shows that we post on the Purple Pawn, and we do answer them. Not necessarily instantly, because the Purple Pawn is blocked at my
work.
We're
pretty good
about it. Because it's a game website. We do get back to them. We will answer your questions if you post there. And if they're applicable, we'll actually read those questions on the next show as well. And you were going to say.
I was just going to say exactly that we were going to answer shows on the next show.
Oh, I apologize. I didn't mean to steal your thunder.
Oh, well, that's all.
Well, thunder away on the upcoming stuff then.
Well, upcoming stuff. The big one for March is the Gamma Trade Show, which will be March 11th through 15th in Vegas again, as usual.
At Scenic Valley's Casino.
At Scenic Valley's Casino.
Home of the Beige and Brown Velour.
Oh, home of Beige and Brown.
Or Beige and Purple, I think. Yeah, Beige and Purple.
Beige and Purple, is it?
Yeah.
So, you know, they're all lost on me.
Yeah, that's all right. Hey, real quick, though, Rhett, because our next show is going to come out after Gamma Trade Show. Who should go to Gamma Trade Show? I know we've talked about this before, but let's you know, we just spent, an hour talking about very specifically things to do before you print your game. Who should go to the show?
Well, the primary ones I would say that need to go to the show are those people interested in the standard gaming type of pieces.
So the hobby market, right?
The hobby market, the traditional market of hobby market. So retailers who are looking to expand their market or find out new news about what's upcoming and what's going on. I'm sure Wizards of the Coast has plenty of answers about what's going to be happening with the new upcoming D&D. I expect that Paizo will be there with answers as well. Other manufacturers, you're probably best off to look at the Gamma listings to find out what other manufacturers are going to be in attendance, if any of the people that you're really wanting to see may or may not be there.
Yeah, for instance, Games Workshop never attends.
Games Workshop does not attend because Games Workshop is the hobby. There's little air quotes there for all of you who can't see that. And the only way to hear from Games Workshop is to contact Games Workshop directly, yeah. And they will explain all about their miniatures as nothing else exists.
Correct. But occasionally, some of the big guys will not be at Gamma Trade Show.
That's true. Fantasy Flight does not typically attend. They have attended on occasion. I would expect that with the Star Wars ones, there's a higher possibility that they'll be there. I didn't actually look at this year's form to know if they were there or not.
Yeah. The other thing to remember, too, is that this isn't a public show. This is just retailers, the distributors, and the manufacturers. There's no walk-in street traffic. So you can't go to Gamma Trade Show and sell your game. Unless you're going to write a floor order. But it's a lot like New York Toy Fair that way, in that this is not a general public show. It's very much, it's just an industry show, which is good in some respects, bad in others.
Yes, it is purely an industry show. This is a good place if you've got a new game that you're trying to launch to be there. One of the nice things is it gives you contact with all the distributors. All the distributors will be there. And primarily, they are your first market to get into. If you can't get into them, it becomes much more of a challenge to get into the retail stores.
Yeah, this is a great show to go to if you're a retailer, precisely because of the fact that it gives you one-on-one access to these people, and you're not fighting for time the way at Gen Con, half these guys are being swarmed by the general public, and they need to sell those games to the general public so that they can, pay for the booth. At GTS, it's just about you, the retailer. You're the target audience.
The questions and answers are geared towards you. What's upcoming? Yes. Any other technical things that you want to know? Are you going to support this game in some way with, let's say, demo teams or posters or whatever? What other licensing have you got? You know, is there other products lines that we should be looking at that are related to yours? All those kind of questions, yes, they'd be happy to answer for you.
And there's also some very good retail seminars.
There are exceptional retail seminars. Yes. There's some really, really useful ones, both for the top stores and the people, you know, getting into it and looking to expand and just make a better job for themselves, you know, do a better job at what they're doing.
The absolute best presentation I have ever seen on the subject was talking about local marketing at Gamma Trade Show. And it was fantastic talking about how to become a news source for your local newspaper or whatever on games, you know, and how to develop a relationship with a reporter so that your store gets mentioned and so he remembers to call you for quotes and stuff like that. And it was fascinating stuff from somebody who'd actually done it. And again, the seminars, if you're a retailer, I think are outstanding. I don't know if they have any manufacturer specific stuff there in terms of much less about that, but the seminars for retailers are quite good.
No, the seminars are all targeted towards retailers. And there's, you know, there's simple things, you know, how to make your store look better, how to hire and fire people, something that'll, you know, if you're a one-man shop, you may not have any experience in. And then technical things, you know, how to find a point-of-purchase system, you know, what technical details do you need to know? And it's also a nice place to just, you know, talk over things of, you know, we're a local store, we do this, and we would like some support along those lines. What can you do for us?
Yeah. So definitely, again, that's coming up. Our show will be coming out at the end of March. So there'll be a bit of a lag time between the end of the show and our show. So we're not going to go into the nitty-gritty blow-by-blow detail, but we'll definitely talk about any cool news coming out of the show.
Absolutely. So,
and Red, on that note, take us out of here.
Well, that's it for this week, or this show, I should say. We will speak to you in the end of March. I'm Rhett Kipp.
And I'm not. Okay, I thought that was funny.